On board the Air Force plane the morning after the wreck, Wilson felt about as low as a snake's belly. For the first time, he too wondered if he had any legitimacy left. The Afghan cause had sustained his self-respect throughout the worst of the drug days, but now he didn't know if he could even go through with this campaign to win over Doc Long. Luckily, Joanne Herring was waiting for him in Paris, ready to breathe pure inspiration back into the deflated and badly hungover congressman. Right away, he told her that his career might be over, that the hit and run on top of the dope charges might well be the last straw. He was offering to let her off the hook. But nothing that Charlie did that year seemed to shake her. Not the drugs, not the stories of Liz and the hot tub, not even the belly dancer in Pakistan pretending to be the congressman's secretary. The hit and run on the Key Bridge she treated as little more than a speeding violation. Perhaps the best explanation as to why she was so forgiving is that Joanne Herring that summer was very much in the throes of her born-again revelations. Just the year before, she had found Christ, and, like all born-agains, the tempter was a very familiar figure to her. As she saw it, the devil was throwing roadblocks in her man's way, trying to derail him because Charlie was headed into a mighty battle with the forces of evil. Herring was a product of Texas Oil and the John Birch Society, and most recently a disciple of the Comte de Meranche's vision of a global communist conspiracy in which even well-known capitalists were agents. All of this somehow coalesced for her into a clear vision once she was born again. She now saw an apocalyptic struggle in which she and Charlie had become instruments of Jesus. She told the self-flagellating Wilson that there was no time for moping, that he was wonderful, and that they had God's battle to fight. It was to begin that very night at the home of the Vicomtesse de Grève, the most beautiful woman in Paris. It had been no small matter persuading this French patrician to host a dinner for a group of unknown American politicians, and Charlie had to play his part. Joanne had long since evolved a theory about the way she, as a Texas socialite, could influence the course of world events. It had to do with grand dinners and glitz and fun, and how you bring people together. For her, a dinner party was not entertainment alone, but deadly serious business. It all came down to the mixture. Business with pleasure, high society with the people who actually make the world work, moving them around from course to course, matching them with partners they would never otherwise encounter, always maneuvering to bring together the ones who could change the world according to her designs. Doc Long was hardly the sort of person you'd expect to be the guest of honor at an aristocratic gathering in Paris, but the Vicomtesse had been sympathetic to Joanne's seduction plan and had summoned Le Tout Paris. As Joanne articulates it today, the strategy was very simple. What we wanted to do was make Doc Long have so much fun that when he got to Zia, the ground would be prepared, just like it had been for Charlie when he first went to Pakistan. She saw the evening as a perfect first step and was fast on her way to becoming each of the congressman's new best friends. The pictures from this interlude in Paris show Joanne dressed in fanciful pink Little Miss Muffet outfits, sexy affairs with a parasol and a very short skirt. In each of these photos, she is the center of a sea of smiles. Doc Long is grinning from ear to ear, and Mrs. Long is smiling too. It's always a big mistake to ignore the wives, Joanne explains, and on this trip she concentrated much of her attention on making sure all of them were on board. The delegation next stopped off briefly in Syria, then went on to Israel, where the chairman was treated with great respect. Nobody needed to tell the Israelis to make an effort with this man who, along with his plane load of appropriators, sent large amounts of U.S. aid each year for every man, woman, and child in the country. Charlie, meanwhile, went off on his own to visit his old Israeli friend Zvi Rafia and Rafia's boss, Michael Shore, the chairman of IMI. As always, the Russian gunships were foremost on Wilson's mind, and he was eager to find out where things stood with the Charlie horse, the anti-aircraft gun IMI had agreed to design for the Afghans. After briefing Wilson, the two Israelis brought up a personal matter. They were worried that their friend might lose the upcoming election because of the scandals surrounding him. They wanted him to know that Israel needed Wilson in Congress, and that since they couldn't contribute to his campaign directly, they would make sure their friends in America did. Then they gave him a captured PLO Kalashnikov, which Charlie proudly carried onto the Air Force plane with utter disregard for the rigid rules prohibiting such illegal arms shipments. "Doc got a kick out of me having it on the plane," Wilson recalls. He also liked the fact that the Israelis liked me so much. The Israelis had gone out of their way for Joanne as well after Charlie had alerted them to her religious passions. He knew that the first thing in my life is Jesus Christ, and he arranged for the Israelis to take me everywhere Jesus had gone, Joanne recounted with appreciation years later. Her experience visiting the Stations of the Cross managed to make her even more convinced of the sacred nature of the mission she had embarked on with Charlie. It seems hard to imagine, but on this trip she says that she succeeded repeatedly in getting the congressman to join her in intense prayer sessions. "We prayed that the dinners would go well, that Zia would be well received," she says. "We prayed for Charlie and for him to have the strength to get through it all, and for the Lord to guide us with Doc Long." As they left Jerusalem for Pakistan, Joanne really set to work. She moved from seat to seat, telling not just the members but their wives all of her stories about bringing capitalism to little Pakistani villages and about how the wonderful General Zia was sacrificing everything to help the Afghans. She knew that Zia had a horrible reputation, and her way of dealing with it was to confront head-on the false accusations that Zia had in fact murdered his predecessor, Bhutto. From seat to seat, she carried her curious and impassioned message. "I want to make it really clear to you that Zia did not kill Bhutto," she said, until on her third stop she encountered a blank stare from one of the congressmen. "He said to me, 'Who's Bhutto?' And I thought, 'These guys are going out here to visit this country and they don't know doodle de twat about it.'" Undeterred, Herring smiled charmingly, filled him in on the real history, and, like a pro, moved her pitch onto the next seat. Doc Long, that magical dispenser of U.S. foreign aid dollars, had grown accustomed to being made much of by governments. But General Zia, at the prodding of his honorary consul, made sure that the chairman got a reception he would never forget. Literally, a red carpet affair with a brass band, braided generals in full-dress uniform, lines of soldiers at attention, and small children with arms full of flowers running up to honor the suspicious old man. Wilson and Joanne now had Doc trapped in their choreographed sequence of events. Pakistan might have been in bad odor with the chairman because it was a military dictatorship, but that also meant that when Zia ordered the military to put on a good show, the whole country performed. The golfers in the delegation were taken to the local country club and served tea at the ninth hole with linen and silver. The merchant at the antique shop in Rawalpindi offered such incredible bargains that the wives were convinced that General Zia had ordered discounts. The centerpiece of the trip, however, was a helicopter trek to the front. It began in Peshawar at the refugee camps, with 2.5 million destitute Afghans in their mud-walled compounds, then on to the Red Cross Hospital, where the delegation saw Afghan boys and young men without arms, legs, some without eyes, none complaining. Doc Long was the only member of Congress with a son who had been wounded in Vietnam, and it was impossible for him not to be impressed with the quiet courage of these men. As always, Charlie gave a pint of his own blood for the Mujahideen, the kind of act that humbles those who don't participate. Then the delegation, wives and all, left to meet the Afghan elders who had assembled in a tent to greet the old American chief they had been told could help them.